All right, tonight I'd like to pick up in a new book, in the book of Deuteronomy. It's the last book that's written by Moses, of the five books that he wrote. The five books are known as the Pentateuch, or otherwise known as the five scrolls or five books. This book, Deuteronomy, it's actually, I guess they derive the name from it as being, you know, the second law, because I guess in the Greek, deuter is second, and onomy is law. I mean, that's what I've read. I don't know. Just take it or leave what it is, but that's how I think they came to that name. Because, I mean, you look at a name like Deuteronomy and you say, well, what does that mean? Well, that it basically means in Greek, second law. That's what it means. It was written, obviously, by Moses, but here's the thing that's really significant, I think, about this book. Even though there is some, I think, repetition in the book, it's kind of a review, you got to put it in its proper context, because I think it's kind of interesting that the book of Deuteronomy is quoted over and over and over and over again in the New Testament. It's amazing how many times it's quoted in the New Testament. As a matter of fact, if you remember when we went through the Gospel of Mark, for example, when Jesus, when he was in the wilderness and fasting for 40 days and 40 nights, and then the devil appeared to him and said, hey, if you're really the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. And then Jesus quoted from Deuteronomy, where he said, it is written that man shall not live on bread alone, but every word that proceedeth from the mouth of God. And then the devil ended up taking him to a very high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world, and says, if you would just, you know, bow your knee and worship me, I'll give you all of this. And Jesus says, it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shall you serve. And then he took him to the high pinnacle on the temple and says, hey, throw yourself off of here, because it's written in the Psalms that the angels will carry you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. And then Jesus said, it is written, thou shalt not tempt the Lord your God. So Jesus uses the writings of Deuteronomy, doing battle with the devil. So if anybody ever questions the divine inspiration of this book of Deuteronomy, I mean, it was Jesus, the one who said, hey, it's written down. It's what God himself has said. Okay, now here's the kind of context you got to keep in mind now. Because the book of Deuteronomy, it was written by Moses, and it's written just before they're going to enter the promised land. The people are just opposite the Jordan River, and they're about ready to go in, and this is about a month before Moses himself was going to die. And he apparently wrote all this down, and then he delivered it to them in a kind of sermon form. I guess the assembly got together, and he basically read this book to them. And the reason he did that, I think, is very significant. It's because even though down in Mount Sinai, where the people originally got the law, all right, well, now this is like 40 years later, and the whole generation that was 20 years old and up, that were given the Ten Commandments and the other laws of Moses, they've died off because of their rebellion. So now they're just up here, just ready to go into the Promised Land, and now it's like Moses reiterates a lot of what was said to their forefathers, or basically their parents. Anyway, beginning with verse 1 in chapter 1 of Deuteronomy, it says, these are the words which Moses spoke to all of Israel across the Jordan in the wilderness in the Arabah, opposite Sup, between Paran and Tophel, and Laban and Hazeroth and this Ahab. It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. And it came about in the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel, according to all the Lord had commanded him to give to him, after he had defeated Sihon, the king of the Amorites, and he lived in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth, and Edrei, across the Jordan in the land of Moab. Moses undertook to expound this law, saying that the Lord our God spoke to us first at Horeb, saying, you have stayed long enough at this mountain. Now, you know, just recapping what he's saying here. This is the situation. When the people came out of Egypt, they were down here in the Sinai, Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb area. Okay, that's where God gave them the commandments. They stayed there about a year, because in that particular time, God gave them all kinds of different instructions. He gave them all kinds of different laws. And that was the time that they built the tabernacle, and they instituted the priesthood, and they instituted their sacrifices and all that. Well, that was kind of a training ground. It took about a year. All right. And then it's only an 11-day journey. It just says here, from Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb up to Kadesh Barnea. Only 11 days to get from here to there, where there was to be going to be the launching pad to where they then were going to go in the Promised Land. But it only took them like 11 days. However, because of their disobedience, they ended up marking time out there in the wilderness for 40 years. All right? And I think there's a solemn warning to all of us today, because the Bible says over and over again, and you can see it in Corinthians and other portions of scriptures there, it says that, hey, all scripture is given to us for our instruction, for our reproof, for our example. You know, so we don't make the kind of mistakes that these people did. We get outside of God's will. I mean, it could really be detrimental as far as God's plan for our life and God's purpose for our life. Look at how many people get out of God's will when they get their lives messed up with drugs, they get in and end up in prison. They make one poor choice after another because they just won't believe God or obey God or follow God. Well, this is here for our instruction. But anyway, he was also talking about that four there, how verse four rather, that when they did get up here, okay, into this area, well, they were on this side of the Jordan, the east side of the Jordan, and that's when they overran these various kings on this side of, you know, the Jordan. And then half the tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Gad and the tribe of Reuben wanted to stay on this side of the Jordan. And so when they conquered this side of the Jordan, then that was where the stage was set when they were going to go into the Promised Land itself. Anyway, beginning with that verse 7, that's where we left off. It says, turn and set your journey and go to the hill country of the Amorites and to all their neighbors in the Arabah and the hill country and in the lowlands and in the Negev and by the sea coast in the land of the Canaanites and Lebanon as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. See, I have placed the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give your fathers to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to them and to their descendants after them. And I spoke to you at that time saying, I am not able to bear the burden of you alone, and the Lord your God has multiplied you, and behold, you are this day as the stars of the heavens for multitude. May the Lord, the God of your fathers, increase you 1,000-fold more than you are, and bless you just as he has promised you. How can I alone bear the load and burden of you and your strife? Choose wise and discerning and experienced men from your tribes, and I will appoint them as your heads. And you answered me and said, the thing which you have said to do is good. So I took the heads of your tribes and your wise and experienced men and appointed them the heads over you, leaders of thousands and hundreds and fifties of tens and officers of your tribes. Then I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your fellow countrymen. Judge righteously between a man and his fellow countrymen or the alien who is with you, and you shall not show partiality in judgment, and you shall hear the small and the great. You shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's, and the case that is too hard for you, you shall bring to me, and I will hear it. Basically, what he's saying is when they were making that journey, you know, up to the Promised Land. All right. Well, he's just kind of recapping for them what has happened there. And, you know, the people were murmuring, they're griping, they're complaining, they're carrying on. And so not only were they doing that, but also they were coming to Moses, and Moses would be their judge. I mean, there were so many people, and they'd come to him with all the disputes and with all their questions. And Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, said, hey, man, these people are wearing you down. You really need to get some help here. So anyway, long story short, Moses picked out some choice leaders to be able to deal with the people's problems and be their judge and judge between disputes between their neighbors. And he broke them up as far as their leadership is concerned. There'd be some leaders over thousands, some over hundreds, some over tens. And the criteria for the leadership was that they had to be honest men. They had to be fair men. They had to be just men. Then he basically said to them, as they act as your judge over you, he said this in verse 17, which I think is very important. He says, you shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great. You shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's. And the case that is too hard for you, you shall bring to me, and I will hear. So he gave some pretty solid advice. But look what he's saying. He says, you shall not show partiality in judgment. And maybe this is a bad example, but it's something that I just heard on the news today. And maybe some of you guys have heard it too. I can't even remember what state this is at, but it's down there by Atlanta, where they put in a new ordinance as far as smoking. They said you can no longer smoke in any restaurant, any public building, any government building. You know, they put on all of these laws. But guess where they can smoke? In the casinos. In the casinos. You see, now you tell me, okay, is this showing partiality? And you tell me, what's really at the bottom of this partiality?
Money.
You see, this whole nonsense of secondhand smoke, I'm just annoyed with the whole thing. I just feel like, hey, man, somebody wants to smoke, let them smoke. I mean, that's not our problem today. I mean, that's the biggest sin as far as this country is concerned, is secondhand smoke, all right? But I just sit back and I say, you see, here's a situation where, again, the government steps in and they're going to dictate to everybody, you can't do this and you can't do this. So that all of these businesses, all the bars, all the restaurants, every place, every public place, in every public building, in every government building, you cannot smoke in. But you can smoke in a casino. And you and I know exactly why. Why are they showing partiality? Because of the money. Look at the partiality. And this is just a small, tiny example. It has to deal with the secondhand smoke, and it has to do with money. But look what money can do for you. I mean, if you've got money and you've got fame, you've got popularity or whatever, you can buy yourself a dream team and you can get off with the murder. We are just swimming, you know, in the mess that we're making for ourselves because we've ignored God. Anyway, in verse 18, and I commanded you at that time all the things that you should do. Then we set out from Horeb and went through all that great and terrible wilderness which you saw on the way to the hill country of the Amorites, just as the Lord our God had commanded us, and we came to Kadesh Barnea. So he's talking about here, now, this is the great terrible wilderness. They went all the way up to Kadesh Barnea. Only took them like 11 days to get there. And then they get there, and what does he say here in that verse 20? And I said to you, you have come to the hill country of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is about to give us. See, the Lord your God has placed the land before you. Go up, take possession, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has spoken to you. Do not fear, nor be dismayed. Now, they're about to go into the land of the Amorites. And remember what I had shared the other night when we were going through the book of Numbers, how, and if you go back, I think it's the 15th chapter of the book of Genesis, where God makes a covenant with Abraham, and he basically told Abraham that know for certain that your descendants are going to be enslaved for 400 years, and then when the iniquity of the Amorites is complete, then I'm going to judge them, and I'm going to use your descendants to judge them. And that's why God is doing this. He's going to destroy the Amorites because of their wickedness and their waywardness. And again, I think the dark warning is there. I mean, God is no respecter of persons. Once your cup of iniquity begins to fill up and it begins to overflow, it's time for judgment. And I do believe that this country is right on that very threshold. And in verse 21, I think it's kind of significant too, because where it says there, see, the Lord your God has placed the land before you. Go up, take possession, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has spoken to you. Do not fear or be dismayed. Now, that's what he's commanding them to do. He's saying, I'm giving you this land, but you have to go in and you have to take it. You see, the same thing with us today. I mean, our salvation is free. God is giving it to us. But at the same token, what does the Bible say? Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And that it also says that faith without works is dead. So, in other words, the two got to go hand in hand. There wasn't one atheist in this entire crowd of people. They all believed in the existence of God, but the fact that they wouldn't obey God showed that they didn't believe him. So that verse 22, it says, then all of you approached me and said, let us send men before us that they may search out the land for us and to bring back to us word by the way by which we would go up and the cities which we shall enter. And the thing pleased me, and I took 12 of your men, one from each tribe, and they turned and went up into the hill country and came to the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. Then they took some of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down to us, and they brought us back a report and said, it is a good land which the Lord your God is about to give us. Yet you were not willing to go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. And you grumbled in your tents and said, because the Lord hates us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. Where can we go up? Our brethren have made our hearts melt, saying the people are bigger and taller than we, and the cities are large and fortified to heaven. And besides, we saw the sons of Anakim there, And then I said to you, do not be shocked or fear them. The Lord your God who goes before you, will he himself fight on your behalf, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. And in the wilderness where you saw how the Lord your God carried you, just as a man carries his son, in all the way in which you have walked until you came to this place. But for all of this, you did not trust the Lord your God, who goes before you on your way to seek out a place for you to encamp, in fire by night and a cloud by day, to show you the way in which you were to go. Then the Lord heard the sound of your words, and he was angry, and he took an oath, saying, not one of these men, this evil generation, shall see the good land which I swore to give to their fathers, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. He shall see it, and to him and his sons I will give the land on which he has set his foot, because he has followed the Lord fully. Moses is basically recapping to this generation, saying, look, this is what your parents did. All right, and don't make the same mistake. We know the story because we just finished going through the book of Numbers. But basically, in a nutshell, what he's saying is, hey, they got all the way up to the border of the promised land. They were ready to go in. But then the people said to Moses, hey, before we go in there, why don't we send spies into the land to check it out, find out what would be the best way to attack it, and what their fortifications are, and what the enemy is like, and send a recon unit in there to just give us a military strategy of what will be the best thing to do. And, you know, God didn't tell them to do that, but they came to Moses with this suggestion. And then what we read when we went through the book of Numbers, I think it was the 13th chapter, it was God that said, well, good, go ahead, send your spies up there. All right, so God said, fine, basically. I mean, it was the people's idea. But you read Numbers, it sounds like it was God that told them to do it, but it was actually God just approved their request to go send some spies in there. So the spies go up there. They, when we went through Numbers 13, they went all the way up and all the way down the land. I mean, they covered the land all over the place. And for 40 days, I guess they were mapping the whole thing out. And they came back and they cut down some fruit and they brought it to the to the people to show them what a good land it was. But then there were 10 of the 12 spies said, hey, man, we can't go in there. The descendants of Anakim are there. In other words, they're giants. Apparently, these people were anywhere between the 7 and 9 feet tall. I mean, they were huge. And they figured, well, we were just grasshoppers in their sight. And there's no way that we can defeat these people. Well, anyway, they gave the people a bad report. These people started moaning and groaning, sniffling and crying and whining and carrying on the whole night long. I mean, they just angered God. I mean, now they had plenty of reason to believe God. They saw what he did to the Egyptians. I mean, that should have told them right there, hey, we're invincible. But what happens? It's like these people were just stiff-necked and rebellious and stubborn. But again, the message to us is the same, that we could make those same kind of mistakes or sin against God by disbelief or unbelief, by not stepping out of faith and doing what he's saying. I mean, I'll give you an example. Every time we got a retreat coming up, to me, it's like a major battle because there's a lot of things that I got to contend with. And, a lot of things I've got to concern myself with. It would be nice to just feel like, hey, Lord, you just do all the work. I mean, make sure that before we go up there, we have all the finances, that we have all the rooms that we need, that there's not going to be any hassles, not going to be any problems. You know what? It would be kind of tempting to just say, well, you know what? It's too much of a hassle. I don't want to bother doing that. But we got to say, hey, man, God is saying, hey, go up there, take possession of the land. And we got to leave it in his hands that we're going to get the victory. But it's going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight. You just have to trust in the Lord and believe in the Lord that he's going to give you the victory through these things. That's why I think that he was trying to teach these people. But, man, they just absolutely were obstinate. And for no good reason, because they had seen God's power, and they knew in their heart of hearts that they would have been victorious if they just trusted him. But they chose to disbelieve. So what happened? Man, God just swore in his anger, none of you are going to see this land. None of you, except for Caleb. Because he believed. Caleb and Joshua, they were two of the spies that went up there. Joshua was from the tribe of Ephraim, and then Caleb was from the tribe of Judah, and they believed God, and so they said, hey, but he's the only one that's going to make it in there, and he's the only one that did. So,
we've got these eyes of flesh, and everything we see, that even though you might see God's victory, the next day it may be the same problem come up, and you say, oh, here we go again.
Yeah, right.
And it's just so natural to, and you have to talk to yourself. You have to reason with yourself and say, remind yourself what God has done
right.
in the past, and make a conscious effort to believe.
Right.
It doesn't come natural.
No, it doesn't.
At least it doesn't for me.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, because just every time you get a victory, then you turn around and you got to deal with another situation. But you know, there's an old saying: different level, different devil. As long as we're going to keep progressing in the spiritual walk, we're going to always be confronting one problem after another after another. But here's the thing: every time we come up against a problem that may seem insurmountable, may seem very intimidating, just like you said, what we need to do is take a look behind us and say, hey, Dan, the Lord was faithful and we were victorious over and over and over again in the past by just doing things His way. And we're guaranteed, if we just confront this new problem, this new situation, with trusting in Him and obeying Him and keeping a step with Him, He'll give us the victory again. Then he says in that verse 37, then the Lord was angry with me on your account, saying, not even you shall enter there. Joshua the son of Nun, who stands before you, shall enter there. Encourage him, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. Now, you know, of course, we know what happened to poor Moses, because these people just basically just drove him up the wall. Then he ended up sinning and by not representing God the way he's supposed to be represented when he was bringing forth water from the rock. He smote the rock twice when he was supposed to speak to the rock, and as a result, neither him nor Aaron could enter the promised land. That was a sad thing, because that was his heart's desire. But again, I think there's a solemn message to all of us that, you know, we really do need to obey God. The whole concept of a relationship with God is tied up in obedience. And then verse 39 says, moreover, your little ones who you said would become prey, and your sons, who this day have no knowledge of good or evil, shall enter there, and I will give it to them, and they shall possess it. But as for you, turn around and set out for the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. Then you answered and said to me, we have sinned against the Lord. We will indeed go up and fight, just as the Lord our God commanded us. And every man of you girded on his weapon of war, and regarded it as easy to go up into the hill country. And the Lord said to me, say to them, do not go up nor fight, for I am not among you, lest you be defeated before your enemies. So I spoke to you, but you would not listen. Listen to the stiff-necked people, aren't they? Instead, you rebelled against the command of the Lord and acted presumptuously and went up into the hill country. And the Amorites who lived in that hill country came out against you and chased you as bees do, and crushed you from Mount Seir to Hormah. And verse 45, then you returned and wept before the Lord, but the Lord did not listen to your voice nor give ear to you. So you remained at Kadesh many days, the days that you spent there. Okay, like I said, it's just recapping some of the situations that took place, all right, over these 40 years. But this is a whole new generation. So he's kind of like giving them a pep talk and saying, look at the mistakes your forefathers made. Look at the problems that we've had. All right, and he's basically saying, hey, don't make the same mistakes that they made, and don't do the same things that they did, because you'll be as defeated as they were. Anyway, long story short, he tells these people, look, they won't go. So God says, okay, you're not going to go. Every one of you, 20 years old and up, you're going to die out here in the wilderness. Now, all of a sudden, these people get a backbone, and they figure, uh-oh, we don't want to stay out here in the wilderness. See, what they really wanted to do is they wanted to have this whole thing handed to them on a silver platter, so to speak. They just wanted to waltz into the promised land, there'd be nobody there, but there'd be all of these houses and these cities and these vineyards and these orchards and these farmlands and everything, and they just walk in and just take it all right, without having to fight and struggle for it. But now, when they're faced with this dilemma or this situation where God says, okay, you're not going. The very children who you said I'm going to have destroyed by the Canaanites, he says, they're the ones who are going to enter the land. Then these people realize, hey, man, we blew it. Let's go up and take the land. Well, now it's too late. Now, see, here's another lesson that can be learned here. Now these people sin presumptuously, okay? Because God says, okay, he's sworn his anger. These people aren't going. They're not going to see this land. They're not going to step foot in it. He was so angry. He says, every last one of them is going to die out here in the wilderness, and then their bones are going to be bleached in the sun. And so the people are panicked, so they said, well, we'll go now. And Moses said, God told them, hey, tell these people don't go. But they still went anyway. And then they just get really, you know, defeated badly and soundly, and then they start weeping before the Lord, and the Lord just ignores them. Okay, there's all kinds of ways that we can sin presumptuously. I really feel like I don't want to be anybody's judge, but I can give you an example, and maybe it's a bad example, but I do see, and I've seen in the past, and I've heard people talk in this vein, where, for example, ministers, well, they'll have a church that's kind of showing signs of growing. Well, I think a lot of times they run ahead of God, or they act presumptuously because they feel like, well, what we need to do is build this big, massive structure to house all these people. And so they just jump out in faith, quote unquote, but to me, they don't, I think, really think this thing through and really pray it through and really seek God's face in it, because they end up getting in debt up to their eyeballs by taking an enormous loan out to be able to do this. And then a lot of times the churches end up going bankrupt. And there are a number of churches today that have done just exactly that. Now, if a church goes belly up financially, I really have to raise it raises a question mark in the back of my mind as to, well, where was God in this? See what I'm saying? Where was God in this? Because, like Hudson Taylor used to say, God's work done in God's way will not lack God's provision. So I just feel like sometimes, preachers, they run ahead of God, or they're just deciding, well, I'm going to do it this way. Even though I think there's so many red flags to indicate, no, God's telling you, wait, you might be able to do it sometime in the future, but now it's not the right time. And like I said, you can apply that all over the board. There's all kinds of different analogies or applications you can make from it. But, hey, we can end up sinning presumptuously. I think one of the sins that I think is very common is that people presume upon their salvation when they basically ignore God, thinking, well, I'm going to get right with God on my deathbed, or I'm going to get right with God after I finish college, or I'm going to get right with God after I get settled down in a career, or I'm going to get right with God once I get married and we'll have children, and then I'll try to get right. I mean, that to me is all presumption. The Bible says today is the day of salvation. Now is the acceptable time. Now is the time you got to do it. So when God says do it now, and we say, well, we're going to do it later, that's sinning presumptuously, isn't it? And we could end up with disastrous results because we're not listening to God when he says, hey, it's now. Today's the day. Don't wait until you get your degree, or until you get your career started, or until you get married, until you have children, until you retire, until, now's the time. Anybody have anything to add or share to that chapter?
One quick comment. It's sort of like he gave them a formula for our court system, like a Supreme Court set up by coming to him after their own. So I thought that was...
He gave
us the formula, I guess.
Right, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the way he structured their judicial system, I think, was very, very practical and very effective. In terms of dealing, dividing it up into people being over tens and then hundreds and then thousands and then, 10,000 or whatever, and then go to Moses. I think that was very practical. Anyway, it's chapter 2. Kind of get the feel for this Deuteronomy 2, because it's not like Moses is just writing this down and then putting it with the other scrolls, because what I believe he's done here is he's written it down and he's giving it in sermon form. Just before these people are going to go into take the promised land, he's basically reading this to them. All right. So in verse 1 in chapter 2 in Deuteronomy, it says, then we turned and set out for the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea, as the Lord spoke to me, and circled Mount Seir for many days. Now, this is the thing. Because they disobeyed, now what's going to happen to them? Now they're just going to mark time out here for 38 years. Until they all die off who rebelled against God. I mean, talk about just completely missing it. It really is tragic that these people couldn't obey God. And to me, one of the biggest, I think, tragedies that I can think of is for people to live their life X number of years and never coming to the realization of what God's purpose is for their life. And so their life is basically what? It's just wasted. And then see in that verse 2, it says, and the Lord spoke to me, saying, you have circled this mountain long enough, now turn north. And he commanded the people, saying, you will pass through the territory of your brothers, the sons of Esau, who live in Seir, and they will be afraid of you. So be very careful. Do not provoke them, for I will not give you any of their land, even a little as a footstep, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession, and you shall... buy food from them with money so that you may eat, and you shall also purchase water from them with money so that you may drink. For the Lord your God has blessed you in all that you have done, and he has known your wanderings through the great wilderness. These 40 years the Lord your God has been with you. You have not lacked a thing. So we passed beyond our brothers, the sons of Esau, who live in Seir, away from the Arabah road, away from Eleth, and from Ezion Gibor, and we turned and passed through by the way of the wilderness of Moab. And the Lord said to me, do not harass Moab, nor provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the sons of Lot as a possession. The Emen lived there formerly, a people of great and numerous and as tall as the Anakim. Okay, before we go any further, now on their way up, all right, they're going to go through the Mount Seir. This is the Mount Seir, this Edom area right here. This land belonged to Edom. It belonged to the Edomites. Okay, now who remember who the Edomites were? They were descendants of Esau. Esau was the twin brother of Jacob. So in other words, they're related. The Israelites and the Edomites are related. Also, they weren't to touch the land of the Moabites. The Moabites and the Israelites were related too, through Lot. Lot was the nephew of Abraham. And long story short, I think this is a spiritual application, simply this, all right? Even though they're not part of their group, they are still brothers, and they're not to go to war with their brothers. Now, this is kind of, I don't want to make too much of a mental leap here, but I just feel like there's a message for us even today. All right, we've got all these various Christian denominations where God doesn't want us going to war with one another. Yeah. We've got an enemy that's out there that needs to be attacked. I mean, we don't need to be attacking each other as far as, you know, I see this a lot, right? Mm-hmm. I think that there's a message there that even though eventually there was a confrontation between the Edomites and the Israelites and the Edomites and the Moabites under King David, nevertheless, God was saying, these are your brothers, so I don't want you taking one anything of their property, and you are to pay for what you use. So you see what I'm driving at? I think that that's a spiritual application that can be drawn there. That when it comes to Christian denominations, hey, we don't need to be flinging mud back and forth at each other. We just got to, I think, have enough spiritual discernment and insight to just simply say, hey, man, even though they're not part of our group, even though they don't do things our ways, they're still our brothers, and therefore I'm not going to be their judge, and just keep moving on. All right, you leave them in God's hands to deal with them. Remember that happened when Jesus had sent out his disciples? He sent out his disciples two by two, and he was having them go through the towns and casting out demons and preaching the good news and trying to get people to repent. And then some of the disciples came back to him and says, hey, Lord, we found some guys out there. They were casting out demons in your name, and we told them to knock it off because they weren't part of our group. You know? And Jesus said, hey, man, don't be doing that. He's saying that nobody can do that unless they belong to me. See what I'm saying? We have this mindset. We get this kind of tunnel vision sometimes and just feel like, hey, if you don't belong to my denomination, then you're not saved or you don't belong to the Lord. Well, anyway, like I said, I don't want to beat that to death, but it certainly has application for today. But anyway, verse 10, he says that Emon lived there, formerly a people of great and numerous, tall as Anakim. Like the Anakim, they also is regarded as a Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Emon. Now, I'll tell you what, I'll comment upon this when we get a little bit further down, because these people are going to come up again. There's different names for these same kind of people. He says in that verse 12, he says, the Horites formerly lived in Seir, but the sons of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place, just as the Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave to them. Now arise and cross over the brook of Zered yourselves. So we crossed over the brook of Zered. I don't know if you can see that here, but now the brook of Zered is right here. So they're crossing over this brook now, and they're basically going to use it as, now that's going to be their launching pad in terms of going into the promised land. And he said in that verse 14, he says, now the time that it took for us to come from Kadesh Barnea until we crossed over to the book of Zered was 38 years, and until all the generation of the men of war perished from within the camp, as the Lord had sworn to them. Now, see what I'm saying? It was a journey of only 11 days, but because of their disobedience, because of their rebellion, because of their stiff-neckedness, you know, 38 years later, they finally get up there. And then he says in verse 15, he says, moreover, the hand of the Lord was against them to destroy them from within the camp until they all perished. So it came about when all the men of war had finally perished from among the people that the Lord spoke to me, saying, you shall cross over the Ar, the border of Moab, today, and when you come opposite the sons of Ammon, do not harass them nor provoke them, for I will not give you any of the land of the sons of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the sons of Lot as a possession. So, again, when they get up closer to here, now they're getting into the territory of Moab, and they're getting into the territory of Ammon. And again, Ammon was a son of Lot. So they were related. They were brothers. Again, I think this, it's put in there for our example. If people who, let's say, are committed to the Lord, but they don't belong to our particular group, hey, those aren't the people to go to war with. That kind of mindset where people say that, hey, man, you have to belong to our group, and you have to do it the way our group does it, or you're not saved. Well, you know, I just leave that in God's hands, but I think that that's not where the fight's at, all right? That's not where it's at all. Anyway, verse 20 says, it is also regarded as the land of Rephaim, for Rephaim formerly lived in it, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumin, a people of great and numerous and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place. You know, here's the thing. We're talking about these giants here. Now, we're talking about giants. We're talking about people probably between 7 and 9 feet tall. And they had different names because they were called different names by different people. In other words, the Moabites called them Emon, and they were also known as the sons of Anakim, and they were also known as the Rephaim. And here, the Ammonites called them Zamzumin, but they're still what? They're still giants, right? So, you know the old saying, a rose by another name is still a rose, right? That type of saying.
Still sweet.
Well, I don't have to go how the saying goes, but here's the thing. We're talking about giants here, right? All right?
Yeah.
All right, what are some of the giants that we have to deal with? I mean, they're different for all of us, right? We may have different names for them. Some of the giants may be what? Financial setbacks. Some of them may be physical problems. Some may be dealing with setbacks, disappointments, heartbreaks, disillusionments, all kinds of different things that we have to deal with as Christians in this life, right? These are basically giants that we got to confront. All right, everybody's got a different giant, or they got a name for a different giant. But basically, hey, in a sense, God allows these things in our life for what purpose? All right, it's to stretch our faith. It's to help us to grow. It's to develop us in our trusting God and our believing God. Because these things seem overwhelming to us, regardless of what you call them. It's still a situation where, hey, we still got to confront them, and with the grace of God, we're going to be able to be victorious over them. Anyway, we left off in that verse. We'll start with that verse 21 again. It says, and the people was great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, just as he did for the sons of Esau, who lived in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites from before them, and they dispossessed them and settled them in their place even to this day. So the Horites probably were these very large people as well. But it says that God destroyed them, and he doesn't tell us here, but obviously he destroyed them because of their wickedness and their evilness. So he gave it the land to their brothers Esau, or the Edomites. And Moses records it here to basically to tell these people, hey, look, God worked on behalf of Esau. He worked on behalf of their descendants. All right, and they had to deal with the same kind of problems, so we can trust him because he will definitely take care of us as well. Then it says here in that verse 23, and the Avim, who lived in the villages as far as Gaza, and the Captorim, who came from Captor, destroyed them and lived in their place. It says, arise, set out, pass through the valley of Arnon, and look, I have given Sihon the Amorite, the king of the Heshbon, and his land into your hand. Begin to take possession and contend with him in battle. This day I will begin to put the dread and the fear of you upon the people everywhere under the heavens, who, when they hear the report of you, shall tremble and be in anguish because of you. So I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemoth to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, with words of peace, saying, let me pass through your land, and I will travel only on the highway, and I will not turn aside to the right or to the left. but you sell me food for money so that I may eat, and give me water for money so that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot, just as the sons of Esau who live in Seir and the Moabites who live in Ar did for me, until I cross over the Jordan into the land which the Lord our God is giving to us. But Sihon the king of Heshbon was not willing for us to pass through his land, for the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate in order to deliver him into your hand, as he is today. And the Lord said to me, see, I have begun to deliver Sihon and his land over to you. Begin to occupy, that you may possess his land. Then Sihon with all of his peoples came out to meet us in the battle at Jahaz. And the Lord our God delivered him over to us, and we defeated him with his sons and all of his people. So we captured all of his cities at that time, and utterly destroyed the men, the women, the children of every city. We left no survivor, and we took only the animals as our booty, and the spoils of the city which we had captured from Aorer, which is on the edge of the valley of Arnon, and from the city which is in the valley, even to Gilead. There was no city that was too high for us. The Lord our God delivered all over to us. Only you did not go near the land of the sons of Ammon, all along the river of Jabbok, and the cities of the hill country, and wherever the Lord our God had commanded us. Okay, they're just winding this chapter down. He's basically just recapping for them what had taken place. Anyway, what happened was that this king of Sihon, he's the one who lived on this side of the east side of the Jordan. And this was basically his land here. And what God did is he just hardened his king's heart when Moses sent a request to him saying, look, let us pass through the land. We won't bother you, just like we did with the Edomites and the Moabites. We'll just pay for our water. We'll pay for our food. And we're going to go on the other side. Anyway, it says God hardened his heart, basically to provoke a fight there, because he wanted to bring judgment upon him and his people and give that land to his people. And I think that's kind of significant, too, because how does God harden somebody's heart? If you go back and remember when we went through the book of Exodus, and we read about how God hardened Pharaoh's heart. If I'm not mistaken, it was over six times. I think it was eight times. Eight times it says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart, and then eight times it says that Pharaoh hardened his heart. Don't quote me on that number there, but I think it was eight times that God did it and eight times that Pharaoh did it. But how does God harden a person's heart? Just by shining light on. All right? I mean, when Jesus says in the New Testament, behold, I stand at the door and knock. And if you hear my voice and you open the door, you know, invite me in, I will sup with you and you with me. In other words, the way a person's heart gets hardened is when God knocks on the person's heart. All right? And if the person refuses, they harden their own heart. It's like the same sun that will melt wax will, you know, harden clay. It's the same situation where Jesus said, hey, men prefer darkness rather than light. Why? Because their deeds are evil. So when God shines his light on them, all right, they harden their heart and withdraw. But it's the way God hardens them is by shining his light on them. So you can't hold God accountable. So anyway, it was God's intention that this particular king and his people, they were going to be destroyed because of why? Because of their wickedness. I guarantee you, if the king of Sihon and the rest of the people on this side of the Jordan were not wicked people, if they were living righteous lives before God, God wouldn't have touched them, just like he did with the Moabites and the Edomites and the Ammonites. So I know that people sometimes they struggle with this. They wonder, well, how can a just God allow this to happen? Well, I'm telling you, what we're seeing here is because God is just and because he is righteous and because he is holy, when the cup of iniquity fills up, then judgment comes. Anybody have any others here?
If I'm not mistaken, when Pharaoh's heart was hardened, when you read the story, it's because he says no to God over and over again. So, I mean, I'm saying it the same, just a little bit different way than you did, but Pharaoh said no to God. He said no to God many times before God hardened his heart again. Like you said, he shined light, and the way he shined light was opportunities.
Yeah.
And yeah. If you read it, Pharaoh said, no, God, no, 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 no.
Yeah.
He did his own thing. And it's like, to me, there's times, you know, that you're throwing your pearls to swine because they trump all over it. They don't want to know God's truth, and it doesn't mean that, you know, you don't love them or don't want them to come to repentance, but you know they won't listen.
Yeah, right.
Because they're hardened.